Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 79. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest Lee Van Ham, executive director of Jubilee One Earth Economics and author of the forthcoming book, From Egos to Eden, volume 2 of his Eden for the 21st Century trilogy. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Lee and I have been colleagues for several years. He writes intriguing occasional blogs for Jubilee Economics and for the One Earth Project. Links to those are given in the show notes. He presents a different vision of the future than my previous guest, James Howard Kunstler. They're both prophets. Jim, a secular prophet. Lee, a spiritual prophet. As prophets, they both show us the logical consequences of our actions and things we can do now, not so much to change the future as to adapt to change, to prepare our minds and skills for vastly different lives in the coming decades. For those of you interested in the church year, the scripture readings as we get closer to Advent in early December focus on the end of time. These two guests seem appropriate for the season, though not in the traditional biblical sense. Lee is an ordained Presbyterian minister. He doesn't let that confine his thinking in his books, his blogs, or his interviews on the Common Good podcast, which we co-host. This time I quiz Lee about the upcoming Volume 2 of his One Earth trilogy. Volume 1, you may recall, was Blinded by Progress. Volume 2, due out in early February, is entitled From Egos to Eden. Greetings, Lee, from Sioux City, Iowa.
Hi, Jerry, from San Diego, and I'm really happy to be talking about this subject, of course. I've only been working on this book daily for a year and a half, not all day, but every day pretty much working on it. So, and more than a year and a half, it goes back at least 3 years, and in some ways longer than that. So it's great to be at this place where the book will become available in February of 2017, and for us to be talking about it today. I just look forward to being able to point people to this podcast that we're creating so they can learn more about the book.
Indeed. Well, this book is the second of the three in the series, Eden for the 21st Century. So how does the content of this book fit into that series?
Yes, you know, that series name popped into my mind several years ago, and I'm happy to say that it's proving to wear real well. So I believe that Eden is a powerful archetypal image. The image really is of a garden that is in every human being, and Eden is the name given to that image in the Hebrew tradition, Christian tradition as well. Eden for the 21st century is my own conviction that you can't locate Eden in time and place, but that it reimagines itself continually because of its deep archetypal presence in our own psyches, our souls. So the second book fits in this fashion. To say a word about the first book, the first book was my effort to understand more deeply a question that confounds me even now, which is, how can we as human beings, why do we as human beings continue to seek lifestyles and to institutions and civilizations that use more than our planet? It really is devoid of common sense. It's an illusion. So all of us, I think, understand that. I just wanted to understand it more deeply for myself, and one of the disciplines to do that is to write a book about it. And, of course, the book allows me to share it with others and invites me into conversations with people. Now, the second book is From Egos to Eden. It's about how we get from where we are in a pretty much an ego consciousness to a greater consciousness where we really say, okay, I see this as an illusion. I refuse to continue to live this way. And I now see that I don't have to. Because lots of times we can say, well, it's not the way we want to live, but what are my choices really? And I can green up my life, but can I really get to where my life is sustainable given the structures of civilization? I think that's really a tough question. And I can't claim to have achieved it. But the second book is about the transformation that's involved in ourselves and in our social structures to get to living beyond our own ego way of looking at the world. I hope that makes sense to you.
Indeed. Well, the book agrees with those who say that the current crises are beyond anything our species has ever faced. What is it about our current moment that makes it so daunting?
Thomas Berry, who called himself a geologian because he was so interested in the earth, hence geo, and he was also a priest and a theologian, extraordinaire, actually. So he called himself a geologian. Thomas Berry observed in his, or you know, just spelled out is what I mean to say, not observed, but spelled out in his book, the great work, our way into the future. How that we are leaving the Cenozoic era, the Cenozoic geological era that has been around for the last 65 million years, is coming to an end. The primary indicator of that is the massive extinction that we are now in. This has happened a few times in the 4.5 billion year history of the world, of the Earth, that an era has changed, a geological era has changed through a massive die-off. So this is called the sixth mass extinction. So we have, depending on who you listen to, 100 to 1,000 species dying daily, going extinct daily. And of course, that includes everything from the micro life to macro life. And it seems like a high number to me. But every time I look around and see who's talking about this, those are the kinds of numbers I hear. The reason we can't be sure is because there are more species living on the Earth than we have named and identified. So one of the major reasons we know that Earth is moving out of the Cenozoic era is that extinction. No human being has ever lived through Earth going through into a new geological era. So that in itself means that the history of civilization has never recorded a change of this proportion. The current crisis is beyond anything our species has ever faced for that reason alone. But in addition, it's apparent that things like the nation state, things like civilization itself, which has only been around for 10,000 years, this whole effort to civilize the wild, to civilize the wilderness, this whole effort has gone awry. And so humans have lived in something other than the current civilization project, but to change out of it is still a massive undertaking, and so our species is faced with that, and this is a change then from what is called the Anthropocene epoch. It's not as big as the Cenozoic era. It's the tail end of the Cenozoic era. We're leaving the Anthropocene epoch, and only in the 1950s or so did we move from the Holocene epoch to the Anthropocene epoch. So at that level, the human species has been engaged, but at the larger level of geological eras, no human being has ever faced that kind of challenge. So we have all of the reason in the world to be humble and eyes wide open, hearts open, really not expecting easy solutions, and to figure out how we are going to live in cooperation with our beloved planet in the face of these great changes that she is making.
Well, Lee, as the subtitle indicates, the book's overall structure follows the sequence of a mythic, heroic journey. Now, how does that journey fit our task of keeping our planet livable?
The hero's journey, that's what Joseph Campbell called it. I prefer heroic journey, partly just because I just don't want to get into the gender issues around this, and there are a number. Certainly there are many female authors, and many male authors agree that that the feminine journey and the masculine journey are somewhat different. On the other hand, if you also think about all of us being masculine and feminine in our own psycho-spiritual physical unit, biological unit, then that makes something like the heroic journey, I think, a very apt term. Now, mythology has many stories about some person, lead character, making a major epic journey, coming home, finding a treasure, and coming home and being able to impact society in a new way. This personage always feels deeply called to this, and faces enormous obstacles, and in the process finds the treasure that is being eagerly either guarded or sought for also by the forces that want to control and dominate, evil forces, dark forces. But the lead personage in these mythic journeys is the one who comes up with it. Okay, so that to me is the framework that I decided to use for the 12 chapters of the book. I think we are on an epic journey, a mythic proportions, epic proportions. We are summoned to it, and we need to go through the metamorphosis, because even though many of us feel like we're already in a progressive, taking a progressive stance toward, you know, what's more green, how to live on one planet and all, I don't think any of us can say we don't need to undergo more change. So the heroic journey spells out the continual processes of change and metamorphosis that we need to undergo, and most especially in terms of psychological terms, it's from ego to the greater self, or there's theological terms too, from an old nature to a new nature that can be called the Christ nature or the Buddha nature or the nature of the Great Spirit, and on, with each different of the world religions and spiritualities having different language that is used. But all of it has to do with coming into the capacities that we have. I believe the human beings have evolved to be able to achieve these capacities if we work cooperatively and interdependently to do so, to move into the spiritual consciousness where we in fact have this divine consciousness as a primary influence in our lives in ways that many of us want to have, and we need to have it if we're going to keep Earth livable.
Lee, you attach a lot of importance to the experience of call. Do you believe that our entire human species is being called to this heroic journey? What is the importance of speaking about our response to Earth's ecological crises as a call?
To me, the call, the idea of call, is something, it's a summons. It's not something we just sort of look at and say, oh, I think I'll be a doctor. I think I'll be a farmer. I think I really want to be in the healthcare profession. Call is something that comes to us and it requires a yes or no answer. It's something that is a summons. Thomas Berry says, we are all summoned to this, and we didn't get asked ahead of time whether we wanted it to. It's just that Earth is now putting this summons before us and saying, I need you to co-create with me the direction we are going. So that's the idea of call for me. It's an inner voice. The language for it, I think we can use many metaphors, but voice is a strong one. It's that inner urge. It's that inner knowing that something's really fussing with me deeply, and it's mine to do. In many cases, it seems quite impossible. It's too big. And that's exactly the situation we're in right now. What we are called to do, to live at Earth-sized lives and to arrange societies that are Earth-sized, seems absolutely daunting to any one of us, and it's enough to turn away from it. But the thing that we know, that call is of that kind of nature. People can look at us and say, well, why don't you get realistic, be practical? But it's in us to do, and so it's our call. And we have to do it.
Quite a few first peoples speak in your book, especially in the foreword, which is written by a Haudenosaunee woman, and in Chapter 7, where first peoples are considered mentors and partners in One Earth Living. What is happening among indigenous and non-indigenous peoples that make their voices important to our heroic journey?
Yes, I want to answer that. I want to say one thing more about call that came to my mind as soon as I stopped talking, and that is that we can turn away from the call, and I have a whole chapter on that in the book. It's not pretty what happens, and when we turn away from the call, it doesn't just stop affecting our lives. It just goes into our unconscious and comes out in really dark and dysfunctional ways. So I guess I'll leave it hang right there, and just how that all works awaits you as a reader, as a potential reader of the book. But now to the first peoples. It occurred to me as I was writing that first peoples have a long traditional history of living in cooperation with our planet and with nature in ways that civilization does not. That civilization, in fact, thought it to be itself to be superior to what first peoples were doing around the globe. It's a very universal experience. So I wanted to bring the voices of first people into the book. So I was enormously grateful when Patricia St. Onge, a Haudenosaunee woman, agreed to write the foreword. She really helped me a lot with one of the chapters on First Peoples. She said, when she looked at the chapter the way I first wrote it, she said, Lee, I feel like you're talking about me, but I don't feel like you're giving voices. You don't really have First Peoples' voices there. So that was just one of the ways she helped me change it. Another thing that she emphasized is so important is that again and again, when we hear white people talk about us, they talk about us as a relic of the past, that we aren't really living, you know, lives engaging the issues of today. So I addressed that in the seventh chapter, because of course First Peoples are enormously engaged in this, and as we know from this last month, what's happening in the Dakotas, where there is an oil line being constructed, and the First Peoples have been able to arrest that pipeline. By the way, if you hear a chicken cackling in the background, that's just because right outside of this quote-unquote studio, there are chickens sounding forth from nature, and it's our little effort here in this household to learn from the animals and be connected with them. I don't have much control over when they decide to cackle. Back to the First Peoples. So what's happening today? Well, as a chapter in the book says with more detail than I can give here, we're in the time today of the seventh fire or the seventh prophecy. Different tribes use different languages. And in that time, in that period, indigenous peoples find that non-indigenous peoples are more willing than in times past, more open than in times past, to learn from First Peoples how to live on our planet. And it's simultaneously First Peoples recognize that it's the time when they are more willing to share with non-indigenous peoples their own, if you will, secrets of how to live in a first, in a one earth way. It's very important that we realize that we don't become indigenous peoples. That's a kind of exploitative kind of thing that happens in some people's minds. But what we need to do is all first, not indigenous people and non-indigenous people working together to create one earth societies, earth-sized living, lifestyles, societies, governance, education, all of that. First peoples are, I feel, terrific guides, especially those who have been living the traditional ways for generations. So I'm delighted for what I've learned about First Peoples in this regard, for Patricia St. Ange's help in writing the book. And I feel like the book is able to bring into our awareness in a responsible way the cooperative task that is before us and how much First Peoples have to bring to that task.
On a different note, Lee, it's apparent that Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, has been important to how you understand our abilities as humans to move beyond what we've yet achieved. What is it about Jung that makes him so helpful in solving our ecological and civilizational crises?
Many things, but I'm just going to select one right here. Jung was really good at pointing out that there are two identity centers. He's not the first one to do it, really, but he was able to use the kind of the scientific language of the 20th century to talk about our souls. And so he was able to say there's an ego identity center and there's a self identity center, and he was able to show how different they are. And for us to get to this consciousness in which we can live, the kind of thinking that Albert Einstein talks about that has to be substantially different from what caused our current ecological and civilizational problems, to get there, we have to be able to use our self-identity center, not our ego-identity center. So Jung helps us learn how that kind of an anatomy of our soul, and it's very, very helpful.
You speak about this as an apocalyptic time. Why do you find it helpful to speak of apocalypse? Many use that word to describe catastrophe.
I really got kind of triggered on this by Robert Jensen, the journalism professor at the University of Texas, Austin, who says, we are all, if we're rational, we are all apocalyptists now. And what Robert is saying there is that when we really understand the word apocalypse correctly, it isn't just about civilization's breakdown, the end of times. That's only half of it. The other thing is that apocalypse is about breakthrough. Apocalypse sees clearly and accurately, or at least quite accurately, how devastating the breakdown is, but it also sees that the new is already emerging, and that's what many people fail to see. So to be an apocalyptist is to be able to have the courage, the willingness to talk about. That's what I mean by courage, the willingness to talk about how dark things are, how unraveling how much unraveling is happening, but also at the same time, to speak, which seems so paradoxical, to speak about the amazing alternatives that are being created and how much Earth is working in cooperation with people and people with Earth to really create Earth as livable. So we can look at civilization and say, oh my God, everything is unraveling. We can look at some of the alternatives and say, it's incredibly inspiring. And that's, in a little simplistic way, what it means to be an apocalyptist at this point.
That's encouraging indeed. Well, every heroic journey is a quest for a treasure. What is the treasure that our heroic journey seeks in order to solve the crises we're in?
You know, I really wondered how I was going to word that. I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and the way I really began to talk about it more and more, and that's the way it found its way into the chapter in my book that deals with this, is that the treasure we're after is interdependence. It's interrelatedness. It's interactivity. It's really taking our place as human beings inside of the community of life, not over and above it, as civilization does. When we're civilizing the wild, whether it's in us or in others or someplace else, we are the ones who are in charge, and we're dominant, and we assume that we're the ones responsible to control the situation. That's not interdependence. All the independence movements of every nation state, every independent movement is a movement that is more ego than it is of self. So the treasure of the heroic journey, the treasure of One Earth Living, is interdependence, for us to live into what interdependence means. All of its inconveniences, all of the times that it requires a humbling situation and the humiliation of our ego. Carl Jung says the best way to talk about it is that there must be a death of the ego. Now, the ego doesn't really die and go away forever, but the ego has to be in a role of serving the self. And so our really immature identity must be in the place of serving the more mature and the more divinely connected identity. And that's the treasure. And at that point, we learn to live interdependent with all of life. There's so much to learn there, and it's such a rich treasure, and it's allows us to become new human beings. And it's I think, an ongoing effort on our part. You have to be really intentional. But that's what I believe the treasure is, Jerry.
Well, you join with Thomas Berry, as you mentioned, the late geologian, and others, in believing that we humans are capable of moving beyond greed, acquisitiveness, and domination, and actually create a world beyond our current crises. On what do you base such a belief?
Yeah, it's what I've been saying here, that it's possible for us to move through topographies of consciousness that are ego-controlled to the topography of consciousness where self is primary. And if you want to use theological language or Christian language, it would be you could use there's a set of behaviors that I do, and then there's this different set of behaviors that happen when Christ consciousness is present. The same kind of metamorphosis is talked about in every religious expression that I know of, and in Earth spirituality, there's this appreciation that Earth is in charge, and that Earth is numinous. That is, it's just infested with the spirit, and that which gives life. And so that's why I have so much confidence in it. There's more to life than what can scientifically be explained. And in that, we want science to the fullest extent to help us make Earth livable. And we need to recognize, and science needs to recognize, that it cannot do it simply through empirical observation, that we must get beyond that to the fullness that imagination and spiritual interconnectedness brings to us. That's why I'm so confident that we can, in fact, create a livable world. And even the current crises in that sense can even help us, because they're the ones that are stripping us down to so that we can't just Band-Aid our current situation. We actually have to go in a whole new direction, and that's the direction in which this greater self really can emerge, and we are become willing to pursue that way of living.
Well, finally, Lee, a heroic journeys take us on life-threatening adventures, but finally, we arrive home. What does home look like in our journey from egos to Eden?
Yeah, home is really what I was describing there toward the end, where we are constantly believing that we are to respond to the call, to that call of the spirit, the call of the divine, where we are constantly leaving the world of ego behind, where we repeatedly seek out the guidance of others who we see have something to offer, and our egos are humble enough that we don't feel we have to be in charge and dominate. Recognize that nature is our teacher, that we are not nature's dominators, but that she knows more than we do, and that we are to work with her. We recognize that whenever ego asserts itself, it needs to go through the humiliation and metamorphosis of retuning itself so that the greater self can really run life and society. And that's a very different kind of living than what we experience in day-to-day civilization for the most part. And so it's this spiritual consciousness, the topography of spiritual consciousness, that is home. It's not the perfect place. It's just a place where we really do things in a very different way, and we're much more in harmony with Earth's way. So that's all I'm going to say about the book. I'm glad it's going to be available. If you want to follow more, please do follow more, in fact, on the One Earth Project website. There's a weekly blog. Often it's an excerpt from the book, so you can get a little flavor ahead of time from that. And I just would love your help if this conversation today has merit in your thinking. Why? I'd love your help in distributing it by doing that however you want, but you can also let me know if you know of places or set up places where there can be an interview or a presentation. All of those things are most welcome, as we have a few months here before this book comes out or is released as of February 6th.
Well, thank you, Lee. That's really exciting. One quick clarification. Lee's website is theoneearthproject.com. Theoneearthproject.com. You've been listening to my conversation with Lee Van Ham. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, click window number 3. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for several months and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received a lot of interesting responses, which you can read on simplelivingworks.org. Click on Your Recent Comments in window number 5, or see the link in the show notes. Episodes 80 through 83 will be my annual series for Advent and Christmas called Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, which features writers well-known and lesser-known. Well, time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blogs are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary, faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.